taken upon yourselves to give a little or a lot to keep KPFD rocking and rolling for more than 50 years. And I'm just thankful that you're listening today, because if y'all weren't listening, well, I would just be playing music for myself, and it's so much more fun when we're all together. Have a safe and happy holiday, and please keep it tuned right here to the Mighty 90 KPFD Houston.
Hey, everybody, this is Hayes Carl. You're listening to Houston's community station, KPFT. I think community radio is incredibly important, and for any community, period. I have a personal affinity for KPFT in particular. It's the first place that I ever heard my own music on the radio, and it gave me a home in Houston to come and talk and play music, and it turned me on to so much music, so many people that I appreciate that weren't getting played on most of the mainstream radio stations. It is the lifeline for people who for singers and songwriters and so many people in the community that don't have an outlet or a platform, and so it's just incredibly important. So I love KPFT, and I don't know that I'd be where I am without them. So I thank you all from me, and anybody who's listening, I hope you'll support this incredible station.
Hi, this is Mike Stinson, and you're listening to KPFT Houston, 90.1 FM and KPFT.org.
Hi, this is Steve Gallington of the People's News, and you're listening to KPFT Houston.
Welcome to another edition of the Progressive Forum. The Progressive Forum covers issues such as human rights, the environment, politics, and peace and justice, in addition to presenting news, commentary, and a weekly calendar of events.
This is KPFT in Houston. The program's the Progressive Forum. I'm Wally James. On today's show, we have a talk by the late historian, author, and activist Howard Zinn, featuring his book, A Power Governments Cannot Suppress. We also have commentaries by Jim Hightower and Heather Cox Richardson and Larry Kurzan with the news. Let's start with Jim Hightower.
Oh, thank goodness for Donald Trump. As millions of families struggle with the ever-rising price of groceries, the Donald is bragging that his economic policies have miraculously lowered prices just in time for Thanksgiving. As proof, he points to Walmart, America's largest food marketer, boasting that it cut the price of its complete Thanksgiving dinner package by a whopping 25% from a year ago. "That's a tremendous number," Trump exclaimed. But wait, before we swallow that whole, let's peek inside Walmart's dinner package to see what's in there and what's not. Sure enough, using a trick called shrinkflation, the corporate giant has quietly removed basic Thanksgiving items that were in last year's package, including cornbread mix, sweet potatoes, and pie. Then it shrank the size of the servings of other items, such as cranberries and soup. By shorting the food in each package, this year's Walmart dinner actually cost more than last year's. How tremendous is that? Yet, like his wrecking ball demolition of the White House, Trump keeps trying to destroy the very idea of presidential honesty. He now rants that there is no affordability crisis in America. "It's a complete con job by the media and the Democrats," he barks. "Consumer prices are tumbling down. We have the greatest economy in history. People should stop complaining and be grateful." This is Jim Hightower saying, "The problem for politicians who peddle such lies is that people's everyday life experiences instantly reveal the huckster's deception. Even for MAGA believers, it must be hard to give thanks for a president who demands praise for helping one of his profiteering backers scam millions of working-class families who are just trying to put food on their tables."
This is the Progressive Forum on KPFT in Houston. Up next, we have a talk by the late, great historian, author, and activist Howard Zinn. He passed away in 2010, but his message lives on, what he said then is very relevant to what is happening in this country today. The title of his talk is A Power Governments Cannot Suppress. The talk was recorded in 2007 at Brandeis University. Let's go to it now.
Thank you. This book, it's a bunch of essays that I've done over the last 3 or 4 years, many of them for the Progressive magazine. Fundamentally, the book tries to make a connection between history and what is going on today. That's always been my attitude as a historian. I wanted to go into history and come out into the present. I wanted to make a connection between something that happened in the past, because I wanted history to help us in dealing with the situation we face today. And we're always facing a situation today, especially now with an administration that has taken us into 2 wars in a few years, with an administration that has run amok with power, that has attacked the constitutional rights of people all over this country, administration that has wasted the enormous wealth that this country has on war and on funneling this wealth into the upper richest 1% of the population, an administration that has taken power unto itself and will not listen to anything that anybody says except maybe 4 or 5 people around the president. So we're in a situation now where we, I think, desperately need to learn something from history, because I feel that if people of the United States at that moment when George Bush got up before the microphone and said, you know, we must go to war, 9/11 took place, terrorist act took place, and therefore we must go to war against Afghanistan. Well, if people listening knew history, they would not immediately rush, as most Americans did at that point. 80% of Americans rushed to say yes, yes. Congress, of course, rushed to say yes, because that's the job of Congress, to say yes whenever the president wants to go to war. But if people knew some history, there would not be that rush to support a war. There would not be that that acceptance of the idea, oh, we're going to war to fight terrorism. There would not be an acceptance of the idea, we're going to war to bring democracy to Iraq, bring democracy to the whole Middle East. Because if people knew some history, they would know of all those instances in the American past when presidents have come before the public and said, well, as President Polk did in 1846, we've got to go into Mexico to spread civilization to the Mexicans. Or as McKinley did in 1898, oh, we've got to go to Cuba to liberate the Cubans. We're always liberating somebody. But we went into Cuba and we liberated the Cubans. In fact, we did. We liberated the Cubans from Spain, but not from us. And that's our record. Our record is sometimes liberating people from other tyrants and then imposing our will on them. So the Spanish were out of Cuba in 1898, and American corporations and American military were in Cuba and stayed there for a very long time, dictatorship after dictatorship after dictatorship, supported by the United States. If people knew some of that history, if they knew the history of the American occupation of the Philippines, they would be very wary of an American occupation of Iraq. They'd be very wary of the idea, oh, we're occupying Iraq so that we can bring democracy to Iraq. We fought a bloody war in the Philippines. We committed massacres in the Philippines. And then we occupied the Philippine islands for 50 years. And did we bring democracy to the Philippines? We brought dictatorship after dictatorship and misery to the Filipino people, about 500,000 of whom had died in the war that we waged against the Filipinos. And, of course, the history then into the 20th century, into the Marines going again and again into the Caribbean. General Smedley Butler, a Marine general who won 2 Congressional Medals of Honor, leading the military into various countries in Central America. And at a certain point, he stopped and turned around and said, you know, I was an errand boy for Wall Street. He realized that what he had done, what the American military had done in Central America, was to try to make Central America, the various countries in Central America, in the Caribbean, in Haiti, in the Dominican Republic, in Nicaragua, in Honduras, to make them profitable places for American corporations not places where democracy would flourish. In fact, democracy did not flourish in all of those places where we sent the Marines to take over and to do the bidding of American economic interests. And of course, bringing the history up to more recent time, if people even studied closely the history of the Vietnam War, that wasn't that long ago, was it? There are actually people here who remember the Vietnam War. Despite the attempts of the media to forget the Vietnam War, despite the attempts of our political leaders, you know, when we went into Iraq the first time in 1991 and won this quick, smashing victory, a splendid little war just like the Spanish-American War, a very quick, victorious war. And George Bush said, Senior, that's the smarter one, George Bush Sr. said, we have now buried the Vietnam syndrome in the sands of the Arabian Peninsula. Rare poetic statement out of the White House. Well, the fact is we have not buried the Vietnam syndrome. Vietnam is coming back to haunt us, and people are thinking about that more and more every day. And if people remembered Vietnam, they would remember how the calls for withdrawal that came early on. In 1967, I wrote a book called Vietnam, The Logic of Withdrawal. Mine was the first book that called simply for the United States to get out, not equivocating, not setting timetables, not saying we'll get out if and when, we're not going to go to Paris and negotiate for 5 years or 6 years. We just had to get out. And the arguments against that at that time were the same as the arguments today. When people say, as I say, and as a number of people have said, as Congressman Murta, a Vietnam veteran, said, no, we must just leave. We don't belong there. It's not our country. Get out of there. Let the Iraqis determine their own destiny, as difficult as it will be, but we are making it more difficult by our occupation. And the arguments then were the same. Well, we can't do that. There'll be chaos. There'll be chaos in Vietnam? There was chaos in Vietnam. We were bombing Vietnam into eternity. We were destroying Vietnamese villages. We were destroying their land. We were killing their people. Ultimately, 2 million people died in Vietnam, and we mustn't leave because there'll be chaos in Vietnam. So we stayed. We didn't leave in 1967 when a few of us were calling for withdrawal. We stayed, and what was the result? Another 30,000 American dead, another million Vietnamese dead. And so the same arguments today resonate, oh, we mustn't leave Iraq, as if our presence in Iraq is preventing civil war. The question is our presence preventing civil war, or is our presence provoking civil war? And I think the answer is clear just looking at the history of these 4 years of our occupation in Iraq. Iraq is a mess after 4 years. The numbers of Iraqi dead and wounded are enormous, into the hundreds of thousands. So yes, the history is useful. Not the history that you get in the traditional textbooks, but the history that a citizen learns for himself or herself when a citizen goes to the library, or when a citizen listens to the independent media, when a citizen reads alternative journals instead of simply, you know, watching CNN, you know, and Fox News. So yes, history is very useful. It still is today. One of the things we might learn from history, and this is very, very important, is that the government's interests are not necessarily the same as ours. In fact, are rarely the same as ours. Because if you think that the government's interests are the same as yours, then you think, well, if something is going wrong, it must be that they made a mistake because they really care about us. They don't care about us. The government does not care about its own soldiers. If it did, it would not have sent its soldiers into the quagmires of Vietnam and Iraq. It would not send them into a situation where they're going to come back maimed or without arms or legs, or they come back with their psyche destroyed if they really cared about the soldiers and cared about the families of the soldiers. It would not be taking the wealth of this country and squandering it on $500 billion this year on a military budget. That's a hard thing to grasp, that the government does not have the same interest as us. It's hard to grasp because we grow up in a culture where the language of the culture predisposes us to think, yes, we have a common interest. The Constitution starts off in a preamble, we the people of the United States, you know, establish this. It wasn't we the people who established the Constitution. It was 55 rich white men who established the Constitution. I know you're not supposed to say anything about the founding fathers. They're our fathers. We're all one family. Not so. The founding fathers were slaveholders and merchants and bondholders, really. And sure, they set up a government that was more democratic than other governments of the world. They set up a government that was independent of England, but they did not set up a government that was a government of the people. They set up a slave-holding government that was going to do the interests of the bondholders and the merchants. The interests of the government and the interests of the people right from the beginning were not the same. And that same difference of interest has continued down to the present day. All through the look at the history of legislation in this country, it's class legislation. It's legislation that has always benefited the upper classes. There's always been subsidies for the corporations and subsidies for the railroads. They didn't call it welfare. When the government began helping poor people, they called it welfare. When the government gave hundreds of millions of acres of land to the railroads, they didn't call that welfare. But the legislative history of this country is a history of legislation favoring the rich, to put it bluntly. There were some breakthroughs. There were some oddities. There were some moments in history when this was not true. In the 1930s, something happened. In the 1960s, something happened. What happened is that people rose up all over the country and demanded change. And the demands grew so loud and so threatening that then, in the 1930s, we got Social Security and we got unemployment insurance and we got subsidized housing. And in the 60s, we got Medicare and Medicaid. So there have been moments in our history when the people and their desires and their anguish over their situation has broken through. Then we got legislation that moved away from the traditional class, upper class legislation of the government. But it is extremely important to understand this conflict of interest between government and us. Otherwise, you will think, and the young guy going off to war will think, well, Bush's interest is the same as mine. It's not. Nor is Exxon's interest the same as mine. Nor Halliburton's interest the same as mine. No. That's a very important thing to learn, I think, from history. When you study the history of the United States, you do not see the kind of country that we all learn about when we go to school, which is a kind of exaltation of America. We're not different, by the way, than other countries. Countries everywhere teach their history in a nationalist way. You know, they're all prideful of their flag and their anthem and their history. And the United States is no different, except that we're bigger and better and stronger. But we are, we grow up in this country singing the Star Spangled Banner and, you know, liberty and justice for pledging allegiance and all of that. We grow up with the idea that we are special, we are different. We are the Boy Scouts of the world. You know, we help countries across the street. You know, we have our little problems, like slavery maybe. Maybe we weren't nice to the Native Americans. You know, we have our little problems, but basically we're okay. Well, when you look at the history of this country, we were not. We were not. We destroyed Indian civilizations. We expanded into the Caribbean. We expanded into the Pacific. We sent our young people to war again and again. We did not take care of poor people. When poor people organized, when workers were organized into unions and went out on strike, the government called out the police and the National Guard and the Army to suppress their strikes. That's the history of labor struggles in this country. So it's not the kind of glorifying history that too many of us, you know, grew up with. And when I say that, when anybody says something like that, there's a kind of fear of saying it. You're putting down our country. You're unpatriotic. No, I'm not putting down our country. when I am honest about what our government has done. I'm putting down our government, yes, but there's a distinction between the government and the country. It's a very fundamental principle of democracy that the government and the country are not the same. The government and the people are not the same. That's the basic idea of the Declaration of Independence, which says governments are set up by the people. They're artificial creations. They're set up to achieve certain ends, the right to life and liberty and the pursuit of happiness, equality. And when governments become destructive of those ends, according to the words of the Declaration of Independence, it is the right of the people to alter or abolish the government. That's serious. Those are revolutionary words. But after all, it was a revolution. And there's something about a revolution that brings out some honesty and also brings out the idealistic language and hopes and dreams which may not be realized. Because, no, the dream of the Declaration of Independence was not realized, but it's there. It's telling us that governments are not to be obeyed simply because they're governments. To be patriotic is not to simply do what the government says. To be patriotic is to subscribe to the principles of the Declaration of Independence, to check up on the government to see if it really is fulfilling its obligation to take care of our right to equality, to life and liberty, and the pursuit of happiness. Patriotism, in the best sense of the term, means following those principles. And when the government doesn't follow those principles, the government is being unpatriotic. So we must be honest about ourselves, about our history, about the history of our government. Maybe we need some confession on the part of our government leaders, an acknowledgement, you know, like in Alcoholics Anonymous, where they get up and confess, maybe, Cheney and Bush and the others should get up, you know, form a group called Imperialists Anonymous. And tell the truth, and that is what they're aiming for in the Middle East is not democracy and not liberty. And they don't really care about the overthrow of tyrants like Saddam Hussein. Our government has supported tyrants all over the world. No, what they really care about, it's hard to say this, isn't it? Oil. It seems so mean, so cheap, although the oil won't be cheap. But it seems, you know, really it's just oil? Yes, it's oil. History comes in handy there. The history of American policy towards the Middle East has been based on the desire to control the oil resources of the Middle East. That's been true ever since the end of World War II. Ever since President Roosevelt got together with Ibn Saud of Saudi Arabia, and they made a deal. The United States will replace the old oil powers, the Dutch and the British and the French in the Middle East. And in return, the United States will support the Ibn Saud government. Talk about democracy. The Ibn Saud government, the Saudi government, government of Saudi Arabia, all these years has been as far from democracy as you can find. But we did not invade Saudi Arabia to give democracy to Saudi Arabia, because Saudi Arabia gives us oil and is our ally in our quest for oil in the Middle East. So yes, history is very useful, you know, in all of these ways. Our problem is, once we accept what the reality is, once we look honestly at what we have done and what we're doing, and the question is, what do we do about it? And are we helpless to do anything about it? I think that's a great problem, that people, even when they oppose the government, feel helpless to do anything about it. And so we don't see today, although most Americans today are opposed to the war, and most Americans today are opposed to the Bush policies, we don't see a connection between that opposition and any kind of change in policy. We don't see the wishes of the people represented in what the government does. We are not seeing the kind of actions that took place during the Vietnam War, where the passive opposition to the war became more than passive when it became civil disobedience. We're seeing the beginnings of that with soldiers who are refusing to go back to Iraq. We are. We're seeing the beginnings of that with the families of soldiers saying, no, we are opposed to this war. But the fact is, we do not have democracy in foreign policy. That's a very important thing to acknowledge, because we're always talking about bringing democracy everywhere else. We do not have democracy in this country when it comes to foreign policy. We learn in school we have three branches of government, and we have checks and balances, and the legislator will check the executive and the Supreme Court will see if things are constitutional or not. That doesn't work in foreign policy. The president decides on war, and Congress goes along like a bunch of sheep. Really, that's what they did in the Mexican War. That's what they did in the Spanish-American War. That's what they did in World War I. That's what they did in the Vietnam War. You know, the Gulf of Tonkin resolution. Did members of Congress know where the Gulf of Tonkin was when they voted for the Gulf of Tonkin resolution? Did they know what happened in the Gulf of Tonkin? It turned out to be a mess of lies. But they immediately voted to give Lyndon Johnson the authority to launch what then became a very long war in Vietnam. There's no democracy in matters of foreign policy. And no checks and balances. No hope that Congress will stop and say, hey, let's look into this. Let's see if this is true. And no. And no hope for the Supreme Court deciding that a war is unconstitutional. And we have not fought a constitutional war since the end of World War II. Constitution requires that Congress declare war. Congress has not declared war in any war that we have fought, of the many since World War II. Well, you learn in school, if something is unconstitutional, it's the job of the Supreme Court to say so and do something about it. No. After all, so who are the Supreme Court? Just because they wear black robes doesn't give them any special moral standing. They are political appointees, and they do the bidding of the people who appointed them. So if they don't have democracy in the upper reaches of government, if we can't depend on checks and balances on representative government, that, well, obviously, I think, leads us to the thought that if we're going to have democracy, it depends on us, it depends on the people. Historically, that's been the situation. Historically, when working people found out that the government is not going to do anything about the 12-hour day, they organized, they went out on strike, and they won the 8-hour day. When black people in the South saw that the government, not just the state governments, but the national government, was not going to do anything about racial segregation or brutality in the South, then black people organized. They demonstrated. They went to prison. They were beaten. Some of them were killed. But they created a national commotion which finally brought democracy alive. And that's the situation we're in today. We need to bring democracy alive today, and it requires the actions of ordinary people. And we mustn't despair about the fact that the government has all the power. The government has the FBI. They have all their secret apparatus. They are watching us. I don't think I'm paranoid. They really are watching us. And they love that. So our job is to watch them. Have to understand that despite all the trappings of government which indicate that they are all powerful, they have the military, they have the money, they have the security apparatus and so on, fact is, historically, and here's where history comes in handy, the most powerful governments have had to change policy when the people demanded it. When an outcry grew so great, when the pressure from below grew so great that it became threatening to the government, then the government had to change policy. We have seen governments toppled. We have seen tyrannies toppled all over the world that seemed to be impregnable. You know, in the Philippines, suddenly, a dictatorship. Marcos is totally in charge. He wakes up one morning, and there are a million people in the streets. He leaves. Really. This has happened in place after place. In Haiti, Duvalier jumps on a plane, quick, get out of here, because the people are rising up. The fact is, governments, like all powerful entities, are vulnerable. The government needs people to obey it in order to keep power. When people stop obeying, the government loses its power. Corporations need people to work for it. When people stop working for corporations, then the corporation is helpless. We saw this in the 1930s, General Motors and Ford, huge corporations. We're not going to have a union here. But when the workers left the factories, or even when they sat in the factories and wouldn't let production go on, General Motors was helpless. And so it's important to keep in mind that the power of the establishment rests on our obedience. When we start disobeying, And that's where Thoreau comes in. That's where the great people in our history come in. That's where Helen Keller comes in, and Emma Goldman comes in, and Mark Twain comes in, and Eugene Debs, and Fannie Lou Hamer, and Martin Luther King. That's where they come in. When that happens, then something will change. And our job is to participate in that process. At this point, to light a fire under these wishy-washy Democrats who have just won an election and who are sort of falling back timidly, and they want to pass non-binding resolutions. How about a binding resolution? You know, how about holding hearings on impeachment? I'm talking about a double impeachment. I'm talking about Bush and Cheney. Impeachment is not a radical solution. Some people act as, oh, impeachment. They tremble at the thought of impeachment. Some people up, you know, in the high reaches of the Democratic Party, oh, we mustn't talk about impeachment. Impeachment is a constitutional measure. It's right there in the Constitution. The president may be impeached for high crimes and misdemeanors. What Bush has done, does that not match the requirement of high crimes and misdemeanors? Sending us into war, lying to us, taking away our liberties, taking away the lives of thousands of Americans and subjecting so many of them to mutilation and a terrible future, does that not meet the requirement of high crimes? We have to talk to our congressmen, our congresswomen. We have to talk to them, but let them know how we feel. We have to beef them up and stiffen their spine and tell them to get going, because this is a situation that cannot be tolerated for too long. Keep this in mind about power, and keep this in mind about when the government says, when Bush says, oh, we will not retreat. We will not give in. We will stay the course no matter what. Oh, they ask him, what about the people? What about the fact that most people are opposed to this? Well, that doesn't bother me. Well, we've seen that in history. We've seen people say, oh, I will never yield. I will never give in. And they gave in. When enough people got together, when enough people organized, they gave in. We've seen that again and again. I remember George Wallace getting up before a crowd of his Southern supporters and saying, segregation now, segregation tomorrow, segregation forever, and wild applause. 2 years later, the segregation signs were down in the South, and Wallace was campaigning in the black neighborhoods for support in his presidential race. Things change. Things change. It's up to us to move that change along. It's up to us to bring democracy alive. Thank you.
So if you have questions, feel free to come on up to the aisles.
Go ahead.
Okay. Being a community organizer and a student citizen, I just was asking for some advice as far as how do we stem the tide of cynicism and apathy, you know, to keep that from breaching the levees of the optimism that you exude in other politicians or people like myself or other people who really care about things that's going on.
Yeah. How do we stem the tide of cynicism and pessimism and hopelessness and all the things that all of us feel on Tuesday and Thursday and Saturday? Well, there are two keys to that, I think. One is history, going back and pointing to those times in the past when people have felt hopeless, but they acted anyway. And they acted and acted and acted, and then something happened. That's what happened. I lived in the South for 7 years during the years of the Civil Rights Movement. And I remember when I came into the South in the late 1950s, there was no really important sign of a great movement. And it looked kind of hopeless. But people began to do things. People began sitting in. And then the sit-in spread. And people went on the freedom rides. And the idea spread. And the demonstrations took place in this city, in that city, in another city. And soon the demonstrations were all over the South. And thousands of people were being put in jail. And the pictures were now going out all over the world. And the administration was becoming embarrassed. This is very important, to embarrass the people in power. Even though, you know, we have leaders who are not easily embarrassed. But that, I think, is one answer to the question, and that is to show the history of those times when people have felt helpless. So at the beginning of the Vietnam War, and I remember this very distinctly, spring of 65, beginning of the escalation of the war, we had a demonstration on the Boston Common against the war. 100 people showed up. And a few years later, well, October 69, actually, another anti-war meeting on the Boston Common, 100,000 people were there. The movement grew, it grew, and grew, because people didn't give up, people persisted, and people understood that all movements start small, and all movements start with a kind of hopelessness and a feeling, you know, what are we doing? But if people persist and persist and persist, there's a chance that something may happen. And my second point is to overcome cynicism and a feeling of helplessness, surround yourself with active people, people who are doing things. When people don't do anything, it's very easy to get hopeless. When people are acting, even if the action doesn't seem to bring anything immediate, but after all, there's something about resisting the authorities. There's something about speaking your mind, about being honest about what you're doing, even if you don't see any immediate results. There's something about that which is very satisfying and invigorating, and it invigorates other people too.
My question has to do with civil disobedience and the lack, I guess, of it now. I think there's a lack of civil disobedience because of things like the Patriot Act. People are scared to do that stuff as they weren't back in the 60s. Is there a connection between that and the lack of people doing that kind of stuff today? Also, the truth movement for 9/11, I'm wondering if they had a plan, and do you think there was this plan before 9/11 happened? Do you have any feelings on the 9/11 truth movement?
I'll just say this about 9/11. The administration has used 9/11 to scare people and to do what it wanted. What it wanted was to move troops into the Middle East where the oil is. It wanted to set up military bases in the Middle East, and it used 9/11 as a wonderful opportunity. It wasn't going to do anything about terrorism. It's very obvious now to simply follow the events of 9/11 by bombing Afghanistan did not reduce terrorism. We have, by our actions in the Middle East since 9/11, largely increased the number of terrorists in the Middle East and in the world because we have antagonized so many people. When you bomb people, you antagonize them. When you invade people, you antagonize them. You make enemies. You get people angry. And out of the anger of millions of people, a small number of them may become terrorists. So they've used 9/11. To me, that's the important truth about 9/11.
The last speaker mentioned the Patriot Act.
Yes.
In the past couple of weeks, the Bush administration has fired 10 or more top attorneys in the Justice Department, and under a secret provision of the Patriot Act has been replacing them without congressional approval and with basically no oversight. You mentioned that we should bring people to justice through basically impeachments and such things. What happens though if when the legal system is no longer responsive or refuses to take action or is filled with figureheads that will not act? What can we do then if the actual institution does no longer can deliver that justice that is necessary and needed?
It's a really important question because it represents reality. That is, the reality is that the system of justice is no longer, if it ever was really, something you could turn to be sure that the justice system would protect you and protect your rights. This has only rarely been true in American history. The justice system has been like other parts of the government and generally beholden to powerful interests, and now worse than ever. And now the Bush administration has taken total hold of the system of justice, and it's using all the federal court appointees on the district court level and the appeals court level. It has the Supreme Court in its hands, partly with the collaboration of the Democratic Party, which caves in instead of fighting the Republican nominees. And so, what do you do when you can't depend on a system of justice to redress your grievances? That's where civil disobedience comes in. That's where popular action comes in. And that's where you go over the heads of the courts and you appeal to your elected representatives, since the people in the Justice Department are not elected, they're not beholden to anybody, they often have lifetime jobs, your representatives at least have some commitment to represent their constituencies, and that's why the putting pressure on your representatives to be in holding impeachment hearings and to demand cutting off of funds for the war and bringing the troops back as fast as possible, I think that's a way of bypassing a recalcitrant and reactionary justice system.
Greetings. Looking at George Bush and the way he got into office, I see that a large part of that came from the backing of fundamentalist religious groups, and that their strong desire was to impose their religious beliefs on the legislative process. And I'm just curious as to what your thoughts are on the whole role that fundamentalist religion had to do with putting Bush in power.
Well, you know, we've never really had a separation of church and state in this country. They talk about it as a principle of American democracy. It's never been real. Presidents have always taken their oaths on the Bible. The God has always been invoked. Any president who wanted to invade any country has said God told him to do that, you know, because God studies the map and decides where we will invade. It's just that Bush has gone farther than anybody else in tying his administration to, in this case, fundamentalist, radical, fanatic Christianity. There's a different Christianity. There's a Christianity which is not fundamentalist. There's a Christianity which is not extremist and fanatic. There's a Christianity which is humanist. And, I mean, look at the Catholic anti-war people. Look at the churchmen who have supported social movements. So, you know, Christianity can be used for good or for ill, and Bush has used it, and the fundamentalist churches have been so closely tied to him as to give him great support. Fortunately, they do not command the support of the majority of Christians in this country. Now, maybe they have 20% or maybe 25%, but there's always been, well, I shouldn't say always, that's an extreme statement. I'm not an extremist. There had been for a long time a fundamental core of immovable right-wing sentiment in this country, which probably accounts for 25 or 30% of the population. And there's probably little you can do to move them. The problem is to move everybody else. And when you move enough other people who are not transfixed by this pseudo-religious idea, you know, that God is on the side of imperial power, then it's possible for religion to play a positive role.
I'm a combat veteran who was abused by his own people while serving in the military, and a lot of us who faced similar things tried to go to our congressmen and senators, and they've refused to meet with us. We've also gone to the press, and they refuse to air what we have to say, which brings me to the question, do you have any advice on other ways to get things public? We've tried rallies, and that so far hasn't worked a lot either.
Yeah, you know what happened during the Vietnam War, when congressmen refused to meet with people, the people who tried to meet with these congressmen sat in their offices. They went to see them, and they wouldn't leave. I mean, that's an act of civil disobedience. And that brought attention, and that sometimes embarrassed the congressmen into finally meeting with them. But you know, when the orthodox channels don't respond, then you have to go outside the orthodox channels. But the orthodox channels do not fulfill the requirements of democracy. So, there are things that can be done. They're hard. They require. They take risks. You know, you may be very well, maybe arrested and so on. But in times of crisis, that's what people do. People did that in the South. People did that during the Vietnam War. During the 80s, when Reagan was carrying on covert warfare in Nicaragua and Honduras and El Salvador, people committed civil disobedience. At one point, 500 of us sat in the JFK building here in Boston and wouldn't move when the building closed down. They arrested 500 of us. The charge was based on an old statute, failure to quit the premises, you see, and it was abbreviated as failure to quit. And that's what we have to do. We have to fail to quit. Yeah.
A quick question and then a longer question or two. If I understood you correctly, you were mentioning that government is sort of for the wealthy and the upper. On the other hand, I've heard people like Ted Kennedy and maybe Michael Dukakis and others being ones that have been sort of there to help the underdog. Do you agree with that or disagree with that? And who do you would like to see be our next president?
I'd just soon have a lottery and choose somebody from this audience. And I would gamble that anybody in this audience would probably do a better job than whoever is going to be selected by the Democratic Party. So I'm half serious. But your question about, what about Kennedy and Dukakis and so on doing good things for the poor? Well, yeah, there are congressmen who are better than other congressmen. There are congressmen who are more liberal, and there are congressmen who have a better idea of what our tax structure should be and so on. But they always need to be encouraged, and they always need to be pushed, and they are a distinct minority in our system of representation.
Thank you.
Good evening.
Hi.
I'm a second semester senior here at Brandeis, which means I'll be graduating this May. For the past 4 years, I've been taking courses on justice and liberty and doing case studies on developing nations being taken advantage of by multinational corporations and writing papers about the dominating power of money and interest and this and that. But now it's time to graduate and get a job. And those things are all well and good from behind my desk in my room. But when I look at my job options for next year, realistically, a lot of the things I'm looking at are consulting firms or jobs in the financial world. And I know I have a lot of friends also who are more politically liberal, who are taking jobs in investment banking and fields like this, not necessarily firms that have dirty records human rights wise or something like this, but certainly part of what you're talking about. So someone like me who's more on the fence, I think I'm stuck in an ethical dilemma. I'm not exactly sure, where one goes in the situation. So I don't know if you have 2 minutes to talk me out of working for corporate America. What would you say?
Two minutes to solve your problem? Actually, we all face that problem. We have to make a living, and we want to do something good in the world. And we have to find ways of doing it. Sometimes you can make a living, and in the way you make your living, you could do something good in the world. Only a small number of people are lucky enough to be able to do that. You work for a nonprofit corporation, work for Amnesty International, work for a progressive magazine, write good stuff and get published and that sort of thing. Some of us are lucky and we can do that. Most people cannot. What most people do, you make a living in whatever way you can, so long as you don't kill people and exploit people fiendishly. You make a living in whatever way you can, but carve out part of your life and part of your time to be a citizen of the nation and of the world. It's harder. You have to do two things. It's like a woman who has to take care of kids and do a job at the same time. All of us have to do two things at once. And that's the reality of it. Thank you.
This is the Progressive Forum on KPFT. Up next, it's Letters from an American with Heather Cox Richardson.
November 25th, 2025. Last week, a poll conducted for Global EV Alliance, made up of electric vehicle driver associations around the world, found that 52% of Americans would avoid buying a Tesla for political reasons. Tesla chief executive officer Elon Musk pumped more than $290 million into electing President Donald J. Trump and supporting the Republicans in 2024. After taking office, Trump named Musk to head the Department of Government Efficiency, a group that slashed through government programs and fired civil servants. In response, protesters organized Tesla takedowns, gathering at Tesla dealerships to urge people not to buy the vehicles. The protests spread internationally. In March, Trump advertised Teslas on the south lawn of the White House to try to help slumping sales, to no avail. In September, consumers flexed their muscle over parent company Disney's suspension of Jimmy Kimmel's late-night talk show on ABC after pressure from Federal Communications Commission Chair Brendan Carr over Kimmel's comments following the murder of right-wing activist Charlie Kirk. About 3 million subscribers canceled Disney Plus in September, while Hulu, which Disney owns, lost 4.1 million. Monthly cancellations previously had averaged 1.2 million and 1.9 million, respectively. While not all of those cancellations could be chalked up to consumer anger over Kimmel's suspension, Disney's subscription prices went up at around the same time. Kimmel was back on the air in 5 days. Every day, I am struck by all the ways in which we are reliving the 1890s. In that era, too, consumers organized, using their buying power to affect politics. As the first general secretary of the National Consumers League, Florence Kelly, put it, "To live means to buy. To buy means to have power. To have power means to have responsibility." After the Civil War, an economic boom in the North combined with the loss of young men in the war to make education more accessible to young white women. By 1870, girls made up the majority of high school graduates. Fewer than 2% of college-age Americans went to college. Women made up 21% of that group. Away from the confines of home, these privileged young women studied social problems and the means of addressing them while they developed friendships with like-minded classmates. In the mid-1880s, those women began to experiment with using their talents and newfound friendships to repair the nation's social fabric that had been torn by urbanization and industrialization. To recreate a web of social responsibility in the growing industrial cities, young, middle-class women moved into ethnic, working-class neighborhoods to minister to the people living there. Jane Addams, who opened Chicago's Hull House with Ellen Gates Starr in 1889, rejected the idea of a nation divided by haves and have-nots. She believed that all individuals were fundamentally interconnected. Hull House was soberly opened on the theory that the dependence of classes on each other is reciprocal, Adams later wrote. The people who lived in these settlement houses dedicated themselves to filing down the sharp edges of industrialization with its tenement housing, low wages, long hours, child labor, and disease, along with polluted air and water and unregulated food. They turned their education to addressing the immediate problems in front of them, collecting statistics to build a larger picture of the social costs of industrialization, and lobbying government officials and businessmen to improve the condition of workers, especially women and children. They soon discovered a different lever for change. In the midterm election of 1890, politicians recognized the power of women to swing the vote for or against a political party. When Republicans got shellacked, their leaders blamed women, who were increasingly the family shoppers, for urging their husbands to vote against the party that had forced through the McKinley tariff of that year, raising tariff rates and thus raising consumer prices. Thomas Reed, the Republican Speaker of the House, complained the party had been defeated by the shopping woman. Historian Kathy Pice notes that between 1885 and 1910, the six women's magazines known as the Big Six were founded, including Ladies' Home Journal, McCall's, and Good Housekeeping. By 1895, advertisements were strategically placed near recipes throughout the magazines, and brand names were scattered through their stories, a recognition of women's role as shoppers. Increasingly, reform-minded women were turning to women's roles as consumers to reshape America's industrialism. They came to believe that the ultimate responsibility for poor conditions lodges in the consumer. Leveraging the power of consumption could force employers to pay higher wages, establish better conditions, and protect workers. In 1891, Josephine Shaw Lowell, whose brother Robert Gould Shaw had commanded black soldiers in the Massachusetts 54th in the 1863 Second Battle of Fort Wagner, helped to form the Consumers League of the City of New York, patterned after a similar English organization, to rally consumers to support better conditions for the workers who made the goods they bought. In 1899, Lowell and Jane Addams founded the National Consumers League, with Florence Kelly at its head. The organization worked to combat child labor and poor working conditions, and in an era when milk was commonly adulterated with chalk and formaldehyde, and candies were decorated with lead paint, lobbied for government regulation of food and drugs. Today, the relationship between consumption and reform has taken on heightened meaning after the Tesla and the Disney boycotts. The day after Thanksgiving is the start of the holiday shopping season, and like their predecessors of a century ago, reformers are focusing on consumers' power to push back on the policies of the Trump administration, launching a campaign they call "We Ain't Buying It." "We aren't just consumers, we're community builders," their website says. "We're driving the change we want to see and demanding respect." As Joyanne Reed put it in an Instagram video, "Dear retailers who've decided you don't like diversity, equity, and inclusion, or you really love ICE and you have no problem with them busting into your establishments to drag people away, here's the thing, we ain't buying it. I mean, for real, we ain't buying it." She explained, "We're going to spend our money with businesses who actually respect our dollars, respect our communities, and respect our diversity, equity, and inclusion. We're going to buy from people who respect immigrants' rights, and respect freedom and liberty. We're going to buy from establishments that respect our right to vote and our right to live in a free society. And if you ain't that, we ain't buying it. Let's show them our power," she told listeners. "Let's show them what we can do together."
Letters from an American was written and read by Heather Cox Richardson. It was produced at Soundscape Productions, Dedham, Massachusetts. Recorded with music composed by Michael Moss.
This is the news on the Progressive Forum. 2 years ago, $3.3 billion of federal funding was pledged for Texas through a bipartisan infrastructure deal signed by then-President Biden to fund the Broadband Equity, Access, and Deployment Program. Texas won federal approval for its plan to use those funds last year. And 1 year later, Texas submitted a new plan, and the Trump administration cut the $3.3 billion to only $1.3 billion. Greater than 7 million Texans lack internet broadband access. A disproportionate number of those Texans live in rural areas such as Deep East Texas and Far West Texas. Internet companies that provide internet in rural areas charge higher than average rates for slower than average internet connectivity speeds. Texans have concerns about how the broadband investment funds will be spent and whether the neediest Texas communities will get the investments they require. The original amount of $3.3 billion federal dollars awarded to Texas was the most of any state. At the time of the passing of that infrastructure bill, both Texas Republican Senators John Cornyn and Ted Cruz voted against the funding for Texas. Japan has verified that it will position medium-range surface-to-air missiles on Japan's Yonaguni Island, which is only 68 miles from Taiwan. Japan's defense minister stated that the missile deployment is intended to deter a potential armed attack from China. The Chinese government has said it will respond firmly to the move. And in the final story, in a tattered tent amid the rubble of northern Gaza, 24-year-old Wasim Saeed writes by candlelight for the survival of Palestinian memory. Mr. Saeed's book, Witness to the Hellfire of Genocide, is a raw, urgent act of Gaza genocide documentation pieced together from 2 years of relentless Israeli bombardment, forced displacement, and the suffocating silence of a world political order that continues to look away. Wasim Saeed's book began as a personal diary, but it soon evolved into a collective Palestinian archive. One of his chapters, titled The Untold Stories, recounts the final moments of Palestinian people who died alone, parents shielding children, elderly trapped in stairwells, medics killed while carrying stretchers for victims. Wasim Saeed explained the Untold Stories chapter of his book, saying, "No one knew they existed. No one will mourn them unless someone writes it down." In the absence of independent journalists, international observers, or functioning international law, survivors like Wasim Saeed become historians preserving evidence that could one day support accountability. On Monday, the United Nations Relief and Works Agency for Palestine issued a stark warning about the catastrophic humanitarian situation continuing in Gaza. The agency said Israel is still blocking its international staff and restricting aid delivery to the besieged Gazan territory. UNRWA reported that despite the ceasefire, Israel continues to prevent international staff from entering Gaza. There are approximately 6,000 food trucks stranded at border crossings. Currently, only 170 trucks daily enter, which is far below the minimum needed to meet basic human needs.